The Money Show.
Business Books.
The former General Electric Chief Executive Jeff Immelt is with us this evening. His new book, A Hot Seat, is the topic of discussion tonight. And we'll go through his version of events of the fall from grace of what was once the world's most admired and valuable company. Jeff Immelt has succeeded the legendary Jack Welch. And I found the whole succession story, and I read this in Jack's own biography. I found it entirely weird, Jeff. I mean, there were three of you to succeed Jack Welch. All of you agreed that if you were not chosen, you'd leave the company, and the winner didn't need the threat of rivals. That struck me as weird 20 years ago. You lost capable support in that way, didn't you? Or was it still the right way to go, do you think, all this time later?
No, I don't. I think, you know, nobody's ever followed that, you know, Bruce. Nobody's ever done it quite that way. And I think anytime, particularly a company that size, you want to have a strong team of leaders. And but, you know, we all trusted Jack and liked Jack and trusted the process. But it wasn't the way I felt like it could have gone. It created a lot of tension around the company. And I certainly didn't follow it myself. But yeah, no, that was it was different. And nobody else has really done it that way since.
Knowing what you know now, do you wish you'd lost out and that you had been one of those who'd moved on?
Never, not one day. Look, I think one of the reasons why I wrote the book, Bruce, is that it's a complicated story.
Yeah.
The team did a lot of good things over those years. Not everything worked. And I wanted to tell a more complete story about the company. You know, even in South Africa, the GE has had a massive impact over the last 20 years, and I wanted that story to be told.
You took the mantle in a terrible week. I mean, the week of 9/11. It was a hell of a time to be thrust not only to the helm of a massive and massively complex conglomerate, but also in the midst of a crisis, which suddenly you were the boss of the most valuable company in the United States. You had huge airline exposure, of course, at the time. You had to make big decisions. Dare I say it, on the fly that week. And I guess it was you were distracted from the moment you hit the C-suite.
We live in a time of crisis. You know, from 9/11, we went to the financial crisis and now COVID. I think another reason why I wrote the book is that in this century, so far anyhow, all leadership is crisis leadership. And I felt like we had stories to offer in that regard from 9/11 through the financial crisis, where good leaders absorb fear in a crisis. You have to be willing to make decisions. You have to hold two truths at the same time, that things can get worse, but at the same time, there is going to be a future and you need to keep investing, and how to communicate. But those are the stories we tell in the book. And like you said, from 24 hours into the job, we had to start making big decisions with imperfect knowledge, and in some way, shape, or form, that intensity was maintained throughout my entire tenure.
I love the thought of good leaders absorb a crisis, and yeah, you're absolutely right. I find it fascinating that the image of General Electric under Jack Welch, this massively confident and bombastic leader, he appeared in total control of everything he surveyed. Yet when you took over, it was very, very clear that nobody really knew exactly what was going on in this sprawling business, which had massive global reach. Nobody really knew what the liabilities were, particularly in GE Capital. And that was a huge risk. And you found that out in that week of 9/11.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's always important in another job that a CEO has is to make perception equal reality and to kind of own the narrative around your company. And I think something we confronted, not just with 9/11, but with Enron, and just the higher scrutiny is the need for transparency around the company. And that was done kind of day by day, right? So I think anytime you're running a big, complicated company like a GE, you need to be transparent, and you need always to be working that perception and reality are aligned. And to a certain extent, that was something that happened to us. I remember after 9/11, we wrote off $1 billion in insurance on the World Trade Center, and our biggest investor sold half their stake when the market opened after 9/11. I called the portfolio manager and said, "Hey, what's going on?" Right? And he said, "Well, we didn't realize that you were that big in insurance." And I said, "Well, gosh, you own $4 billion of stock. That seems to be something it's pretty important for you to know. And I think that's the critical aspect of every big company, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we've learned it here with a company called Steinhoff and a massive fraud. We call it South Africa's Enron, and it's huge by our standards. And, you know, portfolio managers, we had, you know, billions of rands worth of exposure to Steinhoff and didn't quite understand that they were overinflating assets and lying in their accounts. But hey, we live and learn. You do concede that 9/11 did provide a window of opportunity which you missed, a crisis which would have enabled you, maybe if you'd had at least a week in the job, not 24 hours in the job, to transform General Electric. And to this day, you regret not taking bigger steps, bigger strides, using the crisis that 9/11 provided to actually change the way that General Electric operated. And it's, I think, valuable advice to struggling business leaders now. There's a huge global crisis, a pandemic that many parts of the world are coming out of. But again, it would be a tragedy to waste this crisis from a restructuring, a reform point of view.
You get a pass after a crisis. You need to think as long-term as you've ever thought in your life at that moment in time. We knew at that time that we needed to reinvest in our industrial company. We decided to continue to let GE Capital grow while we were doing that. By the time Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, that didn't look so smart. You know, we could have thought, you know, and again, what I advise leaders is coming out of COVID, think really long-term about where the company is and where it can be positioned. Now's the time to make those kind of changes.
Yeah, it is. And in the midst of crisis, people are so busy trying to survive and trying to get to grips with the now, they forget about the long-term. They forget about the future. How much offense do you take to what Bloomberg wrote and many other people have written? You just have to Google Jeff Immelt and GE and you get similar sentiments coming through. Jeff Immelt will be remembered as the CEO who wrecked an American icon, General Electric. When he took charge in 2001, GE was the world's most valuable company. When he was pushed out 16 years later, it was in a perilous slide. I would argue that you didn't take over an icon. You took over a company that was papering over cracks that were quite significant.
Yeah, look, like I said, I wanted, you know, it's a really complicated company at a complicated time. I wanted a full story to be written, that there were many, many good things that the team and I did, and there were some challenges that we confronted that we didn't solve. But over that period of time, you know, we were an extremely admired global company. Our financial results were strong. We developed good leaders. But our stock price went from being a 50 PE stock to 15. And that hurts. That hurts the stock price and lots of investors. So, you know, when you have a complicated story to tell, you have to tell it completely. In my case, I decided to do it myself in a thoughtful way. And I think versus anybody that reads the book, I'm more critical of myself than I am of anybody else. So this isn't an attempt to change my legacy or whitewash. This is an attempt to tell a complete story.
So I'm curious as to why you did it, because, I mean, I read Jack's book when it was one of the first CEO biographies I ever read, and you would swear he never put a foot wrong. I read yours, and yes, that observation that you are self-critical in the book. I wonder whether you took professional advice on how to position yourself as to how you're going to be perceived, because had you tried to paper over the cracks, you would have been torn apart even more. So you take a lot of blame for the slide in GE. You do accept responsibility. You do say you could have made better decisions along the way. How did you get that balance?
Look, I had a co-author. She spoke with 75 people. Sure. I took a lot of time. You know, Bruce, I thought about it. I took time to think through, you know, what I saw, what I observed, and I wanted to tell a complete story. Look, since I've written the book, Bruce, I've heard from dozens of CEOs that were friends of mine or people I'd never met that said, look, I never identified with Jack Welch. I identify with you, right? It is a hot seat. There are challenges. We aren't perfect. And so I feel like it's resonated with people that really do the job of leadership. And there's, you know, look, there's a thousand business books written every month. Very few of them are memorable in any way, because most times they're written by people that say, look at me, I'm perfect. I clearly couldn't write that book. But at the same time, I felt like if you had a chance to see what we confronted and what we did and how we thought about it, you know, there's going to be a lot more people that are on our side than are against us. And that was important to me.
And I find it interesting. This is your book, but you talk about us because you wrote this, I think, representing your executive team at the time. I mean, you weren't in it alone. You've taken most of the flak, but you sort of look at it and you say, hold on a second, there was a team of people here. You would have taken counsel. Ultimately, you were responsible for the performance of the company. But you talk about us, and you talk about us quite a lot.
And it's thousands of people who did, you know, really, like if you were part of our team in South Africa, right, you had big customers, you did well. Most of the years, particularly between 2010 and 2017, Bruce, we did more than $1 billion of revenue in South Africa. You don't do that unless you have a really good team, really good performance. And I wanted to, you know, I want those people to be proud of what they did and stand tall. It wasn't perfect, but a lot more good than bad.
I mean, we look at, for example, your role in South Africa and the Medupi and Kusile power stations still don't work properly. I'm not too sure if it's any fault of General Electric's and the installations that were made during that time. But you know that, you know, the electricity system in South Africa is catastrophic and it's on the very edge of complete collapse. And we're taking some steps now to address it. Are you at all concerned about any sort of investigation that could be led by the FBI, South Africa's Hawks, which are the elite crime-fighting unit here, looking at a donation that was made during that time to the D.D. Mabuza Foundation, the man who's today South Africa's deputy president? Are you worried about that?
Zero. You know, again, in other words, in our GE, we did the job fairly, completely, observed all rules and you know, I think we always try to do the right things with Transnet and ESCOM and everybody else. I think the power issues in South Africa are deep and long term and have to do with the way the whole system is run. So I really do not have concerns.
Do you have any? I mean, I've spoken to people who've met you when you were on your various visits here and your trips through Africa. Do you regret getting involved in some of the activities in South Africa as we history being, you know, in 2020? Do you regret it? Do you think that GE behaved above board at all times?
Totally, all the time. A well-respected company that always tried to do the right thing in every country that we did business, including South Africa. Again, a challenging environment. But if companies like GE aren't willing to invest and grow and be good suppliers and providers, no one will come. So I think in many ways, we were always attempted to do always the right thing and stayed in times when it wasn't convenient. We stayed and did good work.
Your GE is onto its second chief executive since you left. Your successor lasted 14 months. A man called Larry Culp is still at the helm. I don't know if he called you. If he did, what would you tell him about GE and, you know, your lessons? Or can he just read
the book? I think Larry's a great operator. I think, you know, the company is going to have a good future. I think it's always going to be about innovation. It's always going to be about the three sectors that we're in, which are healthcare and aviation and power. You've got to keep innovating. The markets are going to continue to change. And I think this is going to be an important part of his future, is going to be the new investments we make and the new innovations we drive.
You still speak to us in the present tense about GE. That's an interesting observation.
Oh, look, my dad worked for the company. I worked for the company for 35 years. I have a GE tattoo on my left
Where?
Hip. On my left hip. Okay. So I I'm still a big investor. So I care about the company. And again, you know, in the time when I was CEO, this was maybe one of the best global companies in the world. So we kind of planted flags all over the world and kind of led with innovation and integrity. And so I think it's more than just an American company. It's a great global company.
We're seeing countries around the world trying to figure out how best to tax multinationals to ensure that they pay at least some of their profits in tax somewhere rather than very little in few places at all. Are we getting to a point where we're going to see the end of the multinational? Today's multinationals are far-reaching. They're the Googles, the Facebooks, the Apples of the world, and General Electric is still a big global company. But I wonder whether or not their time has passed.
Well, I think that's a more complicated question. What I would say is that companies that are willing to localize capability, follow the rules, hire locally, and invest in countries, those are always going to be welcome. I think it's less kind of this transnational context and more being connected local enterprises. And that's whether it's tax reform or nationalism or protectionism, those are the things that really matter in today's world, right? So that's it's a different nature of globalization, but it's still going to be important to solve. Look, if you want to do power purchase agreements to solve the weak electricity sector in South Africa, it's going to require capital and innovation from outside the country, yeah, right? So it's still going to need a footprint of globalization, even if it's looks different in 2021 as it did in the year 2000.
Okay. No, I'll take that. What are you doing now? I mean, Jack made a second life for himself. He was a pundit on anything. If there was a camera, he put himself in front of it, and he and Susie, did very well out of that punditry. I'll claim the kudos of being probably the only person ever to cut him short in an interview. He was beamed live into a conference I was chairing, and he was off point. And so I looked at my hosts, and they gave me the throat cut sign, so I cut him off mid-sentence, and I got the filthiest look ever.
Yeah.
And luckily the feed was cut before he could let loose on me, like he let loose on you at least once in front of thousands of people. What is the second life of Jeff Immelt?
Yeah, look, I'm a venture capitalist, mainly in healthcare. I teach at Stanford Business School, and I'm on a couple public boards, but mainly private, small company investing. I totally enjoy it, and I think the advantage when you retire is you can work as hard as you want to work. In my case, I'm still very active, but you can pick and choose what you want to work on, which is a joy, right? I think what people don't realize in the hot seat is most of what you deal with in any given day are problems. I think when you're retired, you can work the same amount of time, but you're really working on opportunities almost all the time. And that's fun.
I was talking to a former Platinum chief executive yesterday, and he was just telling me the same sort of thing. It's like the best thing is you go to bed at night and you go to sleep, and you don't have the worries as a non-exec or as a venture capitalist in the same sort of way, perhaps. Jeff Immelt, thank you so much for joining us on The Money Show.
Thanks, Bruce.
Former chief executive of General Electric. His name is Jeff Immelt, and he's written a book called Hot Seat. Read it, and maybe your desire to be a chief executive one day will be dimmed somewhat. It's not an easy job.